Good afternoon. This is the Chorus Call conference operator. Welcome and thank you for joining the Banca Ifis third quarter 2022 results conference call. As a reminder, all participants are in listen-only mode. After the presentation, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. Should anyone need assistance during the conference call, they may signal an operator by pressing star and zero on their telephone. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Mr. Frederik Geertman, CEO of the bank. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our call. I will, as always, briefly present the results. We have a couple of slides, and then we will take your questions if you have them. Page four, the synthesis. We had a good quarter. Net income is in the third quarter is 33 million. That's a 4% increase year on year, even though last year we had a 10 million TLTRO benefit that was booked in the third quarter of 2021. Over the 9 months, we book 105.5 million profits, which is plus 32% year on year, which is a record for the bank. We have revenues in the quarter of 165 million, driven mostly by the core business that's delivering on both sides, commercial banking and NPLs. 9 months revenues are at 489 million. That's a plus 10% year on year. And that's another record for the bank. Commercial activity, very solid, driving the numbers I just mentioned. So we have factoring turnover in the third quarter is plus 9% year on year. It would have been 24% if we had excluded factoring versus the public administration, which is a business that we have restructured in the last few months, as you will remember, leading to a very, very significant slowdown. New business in leasing, plus 58% in the underwriting year on year, and we have a record quarterly cash collection of the NPL portfolio at in excess of 100 million. That's plus 24% year on year. Operating costs are stable Q on Q, thanks to contract renegotiation offsetting some inflation pressure that we're really feeling now. Loan loss provisions at 15 million, and that includes a 7 million prudential add-on that's on the performing book on concentration risk, further increasing a management overlay that we put on the provisions. We pay an interim dividend of 1 euro per share. That's a 50% payout ratio as usual, so we're paying 52.4 million. The ex-dividend date is on November 21st, the record date is on November 22nd. Very nice projection of the CET1 ratio. We're above 16% at 16.18% on September 30th, including the net income over the 9 months, that this time we included given that we're paying dividends. So the part that we're not paying out is included in the CET1 ratio that I just mentioned. Let's go into some of these numbers in a bit more detail. Page five, revenues. As we mentioned, plus 6%. I would like to draw your attention to the development of the blue bar, the dark blue bar that excludes one-offs and excludes the PPA. So we have a progression of 140 last year, 150 last quarter, 162 this quarter. It's atypical, I think, in Q3 to have this revenue dynamic. Normally, Q3 is a bit softer. But we had a very good July and a very good September, compensating for the normal August slowdown. Commercial banking revenues at 83 million in the quarter, was 68 million the previous one, reflecting for the first time some positive interest rates correlation. As you will remember, during the quarter, the interest rates started moving up, so we're starting to see some contribution there. On the NPL side, 66 million revenues. Normally, we would have expected a bit less, I would say, right? So we're offsetting negative seasonality there with production. Finally, GNS, negative development, meaning 16 million against 27 million the previous quarter, but the 27 million included a one-off TLTRO benefit, which was booked in Q2 of 7.5 million. All in all, very solid Q3 that you would normally expect to be a bit weaker, but in fact came out stronger than Q2 in terms of revenues, especially core revenues. Moving on to commercial activity, so why did this happen, right? Why are we seeing these results? On page six, a few examples of our commercial activity, the ones we normally show you, so you have some historical data. Factoring turnover, plus 24%, excluding factoring versus the public administration, right? Very lively, market did plus 18 in the same period. New leasing underwriting, plus 58%. Still small ticket focus, so there's no big tickets in those numbers. It's all productivity, and it's especially solid in terms of SME lending, therefore equipment. Tech equipment for SMEs. The automotive side, same level of dynamism, also due to our historical strong presence in electric vehicle brands. Page seven, a little update I want to give you on the digitalization. There's quite some information on that slide. I'll try to be synthetic about it, and please bear with me, but I think it is important, and we'd like to show you that these projects go ahead. We have four pillars of digitalization: client origination, client onboarding, client management and commercial development, that's mostly after sales, and risk and credit assessment. Let me give you just a few hints about what's happening on each of these pillars. So on client origination, what it is you try to generate new flows of people that want to get in touch with the bank. We have now reached 25% of new customer origination from online channels. That was 20 when we started the plan, and we hope to close the plan around 40. We have fully digital long-term lending operational. So if a company wants to, they can apply and contractualize a long-term lending operation fully remotely, signing digitally. And we have fully digital leasing and rental that we will launch in Q1 2023. Client onboarding, this platform we call Next, it's both a platform for our dealers and our commercial partners, so people who distribute our credit, and a platform on which the client can onboard, so become our customer and digitally get recognized, do the anti-money laundering stuff, and sign. So this platform is partly delivered, partly being rolled out. We now have, on the factoring and lending side, 130 commercial partners on it. We're selling 28 products through it, and we've had more than 10,000 client visits of people, therefore, entering an onboarding process or entering a product exploration on that side. On leasing and rental, we have 600 partners on it. We have dealers in there, car dealers, equipment distributors, so all the people that sell stuff that we put leasing contracts behind. And over there, we have now in excess of 50% of the leasing contracts and in excess of 70% of the rental contracts being signed digitally. That includes all the documentation for the purchase of the goods being exchanged digitally. So that's a 100% paperless experience, which 12 months ago would have been zero, roughly, right? These two percentages of 50 and 70%. So we get some very, very serious headway there in terms of getting to a paperless distribution and onboarding of our products. Getting to after sales, the third column, EFIS for Business platform, we have 90% of all active factoring clients onboarded onto the system in 6 months, leading to a fully digital customer experience for them. It means that, for instance, their invoice uploading is done digitally. Debtor approval, new debtor approval is done digitally, so the request and the approval. Requests for increase in limits is done digitally, so all the after sales that a company might want to do when they have a factor relationship with us is done through that platform, and you can see the numbers coming up, right? 150,000 digital client requests, 100,000 online interactions now managed there. Substantially, the whole of the factoring after sales is now moved to digital. That's going to be expanded by third quarter 23 to the whole leasing and rental world as well. Finally, risk and credit assessment. We are completely digitalizing and rewriting credit processes. We're now in leasing and rental on 60% automated digital credit decisions. That means almost instant, the machine approving the leasing and rental. By Q3 2023, we will have fully digital factoring credit renewal. We expect roughly half of the decisions to be fully automatic, 40% to require a one-click manual confirmation by the underwriter, less than 10% to be fully human. Now, if you add these things up, you can see that today we're probably halfway, slightly more than halfway, I would say, and by Q3 2023, this bank will be substantially paperless and digitalized in its client interaction, in its credit underwriting, and in its after sales. I can't stress the importance of this type of development enough, even though, you know, you'll see it, you know, expressing itself in the numbers only over time, but it's the type of projects that we believe are, if you execute them well, are transformational. Moving on, page 8, the NPL portfolio performance. On the left-hand side, 101 million quarterly cash collections. We make you appreciate the projection, right? 82, 91, 101. 49 million judicial, 52 million extrajudicial. We put a little bit of focus on the ERC, the expected cash recovery out of the portfolio. You can see that roughly two-thirds of that is judicial. And that has a quite a nice distribution of workplaces where we can get the salary through the courts. On the non-judicial part, on the extrajudicial part, we give you a bit of breakdown of how the portfolio is made up. Why? To show two things. One is the fragmentation, and the other thing is the age distribution of the debtors. Now, this is a very different business than corporate NPLs. With private individuals, time is usually on your side. So if you have a debtor that over time will improve his or her situation, you can still get to extrajudicial repayment plans, even if a few years have passed. That normally doesn't happen with corporates because after the liquidation process of the NPL, right, the company doesn't exist anymore, and so you don't have a chance to work on that side. So we're starting to see a little bit of difficulty, a little bit of slowdown on the extrajudicial side. It's still weak signals, but we can expect in the coming months and years probably inflation there to bite a bit, and I'll get back to that later. Page 9, costs. Pay a little bit of attention to the numbers here, so hopefully to explain what happens. First of all, I would like to focus the attention on the purple bar, the 5 million in Q2. Those were costs that had been booked as provisions the quarter before. In IFIS's tradition, if you will, we book these requests that come from the resolution funds and from the guarantee funds as provisions as soon as they come in. Then we book them as costs with zero P&L impact in the following quarter when the number gets defined. So what you saw in Q2 was that there was 5 million there that we don't have in Q3. Other operating costs, the blue part, light blue part, is exposed to inflation. So that's the part where you should expect probably a bit of pressure, right? Not present yet. That means that for now, although I don't think that this will be true forever, right? But for now, the contract negotiation that our colleagues from the COO department are carrying out is offsetting pressure on prices. Then we have the green part, revenues-related costs. There you see an increase. The costs are related to NPL recovery. It makes sense because you saw the cash collection also increase. And it makes sense twice because the part that's mostly developing is the judicial part, which is a little bit more cost intensive than the extrajudicial part. So the consequence of keeping up the cash collection in the NPL business and compensating with judicial collections The extrajudicial part is that we get a bit more costs. These are revenue-related costs. Finally, on personnel, there's a bit of rounding there, which might lead you to think that there's some increase. In fact, it's substantially stable Q on Q. You can look at the FTE development in the appendix. We show the numbers quarter by quarter. You can see that the headcount is not significantly increasing. Now, in order for you to understand this little mechanism of provisions that then become costs, we show on the bottom two lines, right, what's happening on the provision side, right? Let's start in Q2 22, the middle of bar. You see that as 5 million costs were booked in Q2, 5 million provisions for the two funds disappeared, right? Other provisions, we also had a, we took back some other provisions unconnected to this mechanism. In Q3, there are no costs for the resolution fund and for the Italian guarantee fund, but we have a 7 million provision coming in that will become costs in the next couple of quarters. So there's no P&L impact in the next quarters. It's already in the books. It might look a bit volatile if you look at the totals, but in showing you the dynamic, we hope to have been a little bit clearer. Page 10, cost of risk and asset quality. We have a 15 million loan loss provision in the quarter. I want to underline that what came up naturally is about 8. So still very modest cost of risk in terms of flows to non-performing and in terms of additional provisions that become necessary in the non-performing loan book. It's once again only 8 million. We added another 7 of management overlay, booking it against concentration risk. That's just a way in order to put it prudentially against the structured finance portfolio, where we want to have a bit of prudence in terms of the macroeconomic situation. So by now, not having taken any write-backs for the COVID provisions and having added a bit throughout this year, including in this last quarter, we're now close, I would say we're at about 50 million provisions against potential macro risks, right? So we think that considering that this is by now roughly the amount that you would expect to book in a full year, right? We think that we are adequately prepared for a severe downturn scenario, would it materialize. On the ratios, bottom part of the slide, we show you separately the gross and the net NPE ratio with and without the gray bar, which are the invoices that we have advanced against the Italian public health system. So starting with the core stuff, gross NPE ratio 5.3%, net NPE ratio 2.7%. The 2.1 is there because we classified into past due most of our exposure towards the Italian public health system. In the third quarter, we executed the transaction where we sold some of this some of these invoices. The effect on the ratios of that transaction will happen in Q4, because there's a little bit of delay for technical reasons I won't get into now, meaning that what you should read there is roughly 70 basis points lower in the gray bar than what we show here because of a transaction that's already carried out. Very limited impact on the commercial banking portfolio. We have a 50 million increase Q on Q of past due. So, and I think on the risk in the commercial banking portfolio, I'll comment a bit later on the next couple of pages. I know that there's a lot of interest in that subject. Let me just clarify what happened on the pharma, stuff. You will remember that Banca Ifis had a business of advancing invoices towards the Italian public health system. The total book used to be around 500 million euros, roughly 500 to 600 million. The characteristic of the business was very low risk because it's public, and because in the end the public health system paid, even if you had to take them to court over the delays. in the meantime applying interest rates, and in some cases penalty interest rates, of about 8%. So that business model, the way it was conducted in our bank, and I can't speak for other banks, was assumed to be not compatible with the new definition of default. So after also extensive dialogue with the regulator, we decided to classify the remaining exposures we have against those counterparties in past due, of course, when the payments are late, and to manage that portfolio downwards. We're still happy to take this business with the Italian public health system, but only with counterparties where we can avoid to classify the exposures in past due, and where we can have a very rigorous management of the payment times. A business model based on penalty rates is considered possible, but you need to be prepared to classify in past due, and we think optically this would be, and also in terms of capital usage, this would be not ideal for our bank. So we decided to really restructure it and become very selective in the type of risks that we take. Okay? That's what happened. So we're now managing this gray bar downwards, as you will appreciate from the next quarter onwards. We already made quite some headway on this since May, which is roughly when we, or April, which is roughly when we took this decision. Still on the risk side, page 11, looking forward. Asset quality deterioration, is it there? Is it not there? You can take a look for yourself. I already mentioned very modest increase in past due coming into the portfolios. Also, if we look at the performing book, we still have very moderate signals. Let me take you through how we deal with this normally, both to show you how we manage internally, frankly, so how we think about this type of risk, and also to give you some numbers on the scenario. So you will remember in Q1, we presented this to the market. We did an extensive survey, detailed survey, with 560 corporate clients that operate in the most impacted sectors: steel, oil, auto, luxury, energy, cement, ceramics, farming. Impacted by energy or impacted by raw materials, like farming, for instance, it has fertilizer, of course, right? We asked them, do you have direct impact from the Russia-Ukraine situation on the left? Most of them said, no, I don't, or medium to low impact. That's still the case. Let's not spend too much time on it. And then we ask them, do you have indirect impact, meaning do you have a severe impact of raw material prices or of energy prices? So what happened since Q1? We're giving you an update. First of all, the 530 million that we had in Q1 in these sectors became 490 million. So you can see the beauty of factoring. When you decide that certain situations become a bit tense, you exit rather quickly. Short-term credit has this advantage. So we have a 7.5 percentage point decrease against these high priority sectors. Second thing, on the right-hand side, of those clients that declared relevant impact from these phenomena, how is the rating distribution? And you can see that today we have 25 plus 41 plus 30, so roughly 95% of the clients in ratings of 5 or better. Keep in mind that 6 and 7 are still commercial, right? They're not defaults. How did that develop? You can see in the gray numbers next to it how it was in Q1, and there you can appreciate that we get some modest flow from the highest, from the best ratings, right, into the intermediate ratings. So from the rating 1 to 3, from 37 to 25, rating 4 from 33 to 41, so it accepted some clients from the rating 1 to 3 category previously, and so forth. Moderate increase in rating levels, therefore, right, so moderate increase in perceived risk, and nothing much further. I would consider this a very benign still situation. So I don't think we can do anything else to give you forward-looking appreciations on the cost of risk. The only thing I can say is in our bank, and I think it's true also listening to the other banks and speaking to my colleagues, in terms of risk, it is apparently all still so far so good. We're not seeing any issues yet. Now, I remind you that in this quarter, we took another 7 million of management overlay, leading to 50 million euros of management overlay in terms of cost of risk. So we're not saying that it won't happen. We're saying that it's still looking very benign. And then, you know, if it will deteriorate in the future, we think we're prepared. A lot of it also has to do with how healthy your loan book is from the start. And that's why we like to share with you this rating distribution. Because when you start with a very healthy loan book, even in case of deterioration, it doesn't get that bad. When you start with a risky loan book, even though bonus, in case of deterioration, it can get obviously bad much more quickly. Page 12, net income guidance. Here we want to make a little bit more focus than we did in the previous quarters. Now, of course, we presented 105.5 million net income over the 9 months. So if you just project that, and you take into account that Q4 is normally the most dynamic quarter, then you might assume that we would be closing around 140 maybe. And what we are confirming is 120. Why are we confirming 120? Because we want to keep space for a couple of one-offs that we expect in Q4, and we're going to share with you what these are. First, the government in, I think it was August or September, passed a decree by which they increased the threshold for the execution of legal proceedings against pensions from 750 to 1,000 euros. That leads to a slightly decreased capacity that we have to go with legal proceedings against these NPL debtors. We're still estimating the impact. We have currently a range. We expect that to impact between 0.5 and 1% of our ERC, okay, so the expected recovery of collections. Second element, inflation. I mentioned it already earlier. On the voluntary plans, when you double the energy costs of a family, then the likelihood that they would have at the end of the month, right, the same amount to give you to repay their old loan is obviously diminished. So we are assuming inflation effects on the NPL debtors. That too, faithful to our tradition, we take it as a one-off, so we do the model changes and it will appear as a one-off in our numbers. Now the way this works in amortized costs accounting is that we will have in Q4 for these two elements negative revenues. So this will be booked as negative interest revenues. You would expect it to be provisions maybe, but it's mostly going to be negative interest income. I will spare you my own personal thoughts on this, but apparently it's the rules, so we will follow them. That means that we'll have in Q4 a net interest impact on these two things that we estimate between 30 and 40 million roughly altogether, right? And we want to take that up front because we don't want to take into 23 weights or how should I call them, right? Further effects, right? When we can make the estimate now and just take the effect up front. In addition, expect the first small impact of the TLTRO part, right? As you know, all the banks have published that, right? We have the TLTRO becoming less attractive. That starts between the second half and the end of November, formally and also economically. So that means that we'll have a couple million of net interest income going away there too. So on the basis of this, I would prefer to confirm the guidance of 120 and not push further into increasing the guidance that we already had, and that includes therefore the provisions that we made with the management overlay that I already spoke about, and that includes taking the full upfront hit of these effects on the NPL business of both the decree and of inflation according to our models. Page 13, CET1, and I'm closing. Very nice numbers, going above 16%, significantly above 16%. Where do the improvements come from? You may remember in Q3 that we had transitorily dipped below 15. It was optically slightly less beautiful than I had hoped, but as we discussed, it was transitory because we have a permanent risk-weighted assets decrease of 84 basis points. That's both due to the change in the risk weighting of the purchased NPLs. You'll remember that goes down from 150 to 100%. By itself, that's worth 380 million of risk-weighted assets. And regulatory derecognition of a transaction we had done in Q2 already, but that we needed to complete an SRT process, a significant risk transfer process with the regulator that's now completed, so we can account for 170 million risk-weighted assets further reduction, leading to 84% of CET1 that's permanent that we get back. Then we have the interim results. We paid the dividends, so we keep the payout ratio at 50%, and therefore we show it in the CET1. Those are the two more important ones, leading us to a very comfortable 16% CET1 ratio, which incidentally is more than our MREL requirement. It means, for those that are interested in these types of things, that we don't have any specific MREL issues around bonds or other stuff, because the capital that we have is enough to satisfy the regulatory requirement, making us very comfortable also on that front. We maintain the payout ratio at 50%, and we consider this CET1 ratio as a guarantee of being able to pay the dividends in the future, if such a thing exists, right? But let's put it, let's call it an extra safety. I wouldn't use the word guarantee. And also, we regard it as strategic flexibility. So in case something would come up that is core business, that looks nice, that adds value, we might be able to purchase it without too much worries about the capital effect. That's the significance of 16.18, so we're not planning anything special, neither buybacks nor macro dividends on top of the 50% that you are aware of. I've finalized the part of the slides that I want to discuss with you, so I would encourage everybody to flip through the appendix. Nobody ever does it, but it's full of lots of details. I think we're being quite extraordinarily detailed and transparent on those slides. If you want, take a look, and in the meantime, I'm here for questions. Thank you very much for your attention in the meantime.
Excuse me, this is the Chorus Call conference operator. We will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one on their touchtone telephone. To remove yourself from the question queue, please press star and two. Please pick up the receiver when asking questions. Anyone who has a question may press star and one at this time. The first question is from Manuela Meroni with Intesa San Paolo. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, and thanks for the presentation. I have five questions. The first one is on the TLTRO. What is the impact on the cost of funding of the change in the TLTRO condition, and what is your strategy as regards the repayment of the TLTRO? The second question is on the threshold for the enforcement of pensions. So do you expect that this threshold at 1,000 could be extended also to workers, so not only pensions? Third question is a clarification on your 2022 guidance. This guidance includes 30 to 40 million headwinds of revenues, if I understood correctly, considering both the threshold and the cash collection. I'm wondering if this number is correct and if this includes also the higher cost of funding of the TLTRO. And finally, if this number is a number that can be considered as one-off or there is some part of this number that is recurrent. Fourth question on the NPL, what is the expected evolution of the prices on purchased NPLs? Do you see some declining prices considering the higher inflation and the economic slowdown? And the last question is on the NII sensitivity. Could you please update your sensitivity of NII to the interest rate increase, please?
Okay. Well, thank you, Manuela. That's quite a list. I wrote them down, okay? So if I forget one, then please remind me, okay? So the TLTRO, change in the cost of funding. Yeah, so the math is very simple. We have 2 billion TLTRO. It went from minus 50, which what it was originally, to plus 150 today, right? So the impact annually would be 40 million, right? 2 percentage points on 2 billion. That would be the annual impact. What that does to our interest rate sensitivity, you may recall from previous calls, it was already, actually it was even you, I think, that asked about it. You may recall that we had an interest rate sensitivity for a 100 basis points increase in Euribor, right? Or in all rates across the curve, right? A shock of all rates across the curve, I should say. We had an estimate of 30 to 40 million, okay? So if we take 20 million TLTRO effect out, right? Because that further increases in the refinancing rate, right? We should expect them to enter also in the curve, right? Then the net rates sensitivity of the bank, including the negative TLTRO effect, would be order of magnitude 15 to 20 million, right? Could be slightly better, but that would acquire some action on our side, on the liability side, right? So I won't push it further, but, you know, mechanically, about 15 to 20 million. Threshold for the pensions, is that going to also be extended to wages, right? I'm not obviously the legislator, right? What I would say is that the threshold for the enforcement of this limit on pensions was under discussion for years, right? No one ever mentioned it for workers. The rationale of the law is to preserve retired people, right? Who have little possibility to increase their income. Workers, obviously, are in a different position. So I think in terms of vulnerability, it would be very different. Now, any potential move on the worker side, I think would severely impact the consumer credit industry as well, right? So there's today, as far as we know, there is no specific plan or law being prepared in this respect, and I think it would be very controversial if somebody went that way. Guidance on the full year, the 120, does it include the 30 to 40 headwinds? Yes, it does, and it's the reason why we haven't increased it, right? And the 30 to 40 is one-off. Yes, I confirm. It also includes a negative TLTRO effect, but which is not one-off, obviously, because it will be with us. But in 2022, that will be very limited because it will only impact from the end of November forward, right? So it's almost it's a couple of million. So it's not going to significantly impact the results anyway. But, you know, when we gave the guidance, we were aware, and when we confirmed it today, we were aware that we also had the TLTRO side, right? Keep in mind that normally Q3 is a very dynamic part of the year for us, right? So we would have expected the Q3, all else being equal, to be actually better than Q4, sorry, right? Is normally the most dynamic part of the year. So we would have expected the Q4, all else being equal, to be better than Q3, right? So that's included, yes, in the guidance. Prices of the NPL portfolios, are they declining? Not yet, actually. That is a bit scary to watch, meaning that we see people purchasing portfolios at prices that both appear aggressive in terms of expected recovery and appear aggressive in terms of cost of funding. I would assume that prices have to go down. It leads us, in certain cases, to bid on auctions where we see that the portfolio goes another way. We can live with that. I think the bank could go on for a long time even without purchasing or with purchasing small amounts, working out what we have. We have actually the expectation to make our purchase budget this year. Remember, there's also a bit of secondary market going on, and we've been quite successful in there. But if you ask me, I think prices of NPL portfolios should come down, but haven't come down yet. You can also look at it positively. I sometimes make this comment. The fact that we have foreign capital coming into the country and bidding on these portfolios is also maybe good news. It means Italy is an investment case still. It means that there's a lively market. It means that, you know, it's a mature market that doesn't just go away when things get a bit tougher. So when I see these auctions, then I you know, even if sometimes it means that we have to let it go, right, I'm still quite happy to see you know, presence and lively participation. Net interest income sensitivity, I think I replied to it when we talked about the TLTRO. So I think, Manuela, I went through all your questions. Tell me if I'm mistaken.
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right. Conference operator, do we have additional questions?
I'm sorry, I had a technical issue here. The next question is from Christian Caressi with Intermonte. Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. I would start from what you said on NPLs and the prices. You would expect prices to go down. I was wondering if there is any risk of impairment on your current NPL stock of NPL in the coming quarters due to interest rates. Secondly, on capital, there was a benefit this quarter due to the change in the rules on distress credits. There is any tailwinds or headwinds that you expect in the fourth quarter? The third question is on guidance 2023. As you said, current 9-month results would imply something like 140 million euro net profit without the one-off that you're going to book in the fourth quarter. Take into account the 50 million overlays booked currently on your balance sheet. What do you expect for 2023? So the guidance could be improved, or you expect some still some deterioration asset quality that could reduce visibility on the target. Finally, on dividends, the interim dividend, 1 euro per share, do you confirm that you are not going to change your payout strategy? So 50% payout confirmed, because it's quite unusual to see such a big interim dividend compared to the full year dividend, because we are talking about let's say 15 million euro net profit in the fourth quarter, so the last part of the dividend would be quite quite low compared to the interim dividend.
Thank you, Christian. So NPLs and prices, NPLs and prices. I would expect normally over time these things they translate into the market, right? So I would expect prices to come down a bit. Do I expect an impairment? No. We manage it as we will do in Q4, right? So we have the models there and the funding that is connected to those portfolios and that is there. So when we have situations in the market that force us or that would bring us to changing the curves that come out of the risk models, then we change the risk models and we take the effect. Now, beyond what we've done, which is prudence, by the way, and what we are doing in Q4, which is connected to inflation, we are not expecting to need to do more, right? Also, I have to remind everybody that we are in the context of a record in terms of cash collection coming out of the NPL business, right? And of a very solid P&L performance of the NPL business. So no, I don't think it would be reasonable in this moment to talk in any way, shape or form about impairments that are necessary in the NPL business on top of the rate of the inflation impact that we're taking in Q4. Tailwinds or headwinds in terms of capital in Q4 in the NPL business? No, we think it's stable now. So we're not expecting any further break or any particular bad news. Guidance on 2023, are we ready to increase it? A little bit hesitant on that, I would say. In 2023, we're going to have a lot of different things playing out, and we're now running the numbers. So obviously, when we get to conclusions, we will be transparent and we will talk about the guidance, but I won't do it now in quantitative terms. Let me do it in qualitative terms. What we're going to have is we're going to have a rates effect that's going to be positive, even net of the TLTRO. We're going to have an inflation effect that is negative. We're going to have costs coming in. We're going to have a cost of risk effect. It's true, we had the overlay, but we're preparing for bad weather, right? So we're going to assume that we're going to have, due to the lack of growth or even slight contraction that some people are estimating, we assume we're going to have a cost of risk increase. Then we're going to have potentially a benefit from being able to invest in slightly more interesting terms on the proprietary portfolio, right? Because there are some good deals out there now compared to how they were, a few months ago even. If you put all these Legos together, we're going to have a cost effect, which is not inflation, that might be, having to generate a bit more cost in the NPL business in order to get the collection at the rate at which we want to have it, right? Judiciary and non-judiciary. So we're putting these Lego blocks together, and the way this will pan out exactly for 23 in terms of the goals that we give ourselves is not entirely clear yet. What I would say is, on the basis of what we see now, we have no reason to reduce the guidance. I wouldn't go so far as to say that we will increase the guidance. We prefer to be a bit constant. I hope you appreciated this also in the last quarters. We try to work on predictability, on transparency, and on lack of volatility in the things we say and the things we deliver. Finally, interim dividend. Yeah, we confirm a payout ratio of 50%. Now, there was a decision about doing the interim on 6 months or 9 months, right? Paying the interim dividend on 6 months leads you to a more balanced, probably, payout. We decided to do it on 9 months for two reasons. One is that would lead to a payment date in November and the payment date in May. So 6 months apart, twice a year, right? It gives a regular interval. Secondly, it allows us to pay the interim dividend when we have a fairly good understanding about how the year will go. Therefore, we're choosing 9 months, and then the choice was, are we going to use a payout ratio on the interim that's different than the payout ratio that we want to use on the full year? And it was just a choice to keep it constant. We want to signal that to us the payout ratio of 50% is something that we want to keep, that will remain with us for some time. So just to avoid any discussion, interpretation, or volatility on that number, we're keeping it. So that's why you have a slightly large interim dividend, and you're going to probably see a slightly smaller, I agree, right, final dividend, right, in as decided by the shareholders meeting in April and paid out in May.
So can we say that compared to a few weeks ago, now you are a little bit more confident on 2023, because maybe a few weeks ago you were not prepared to say that the target 2023 could be reached because interest rates now went up, so positive, and maybe asset quality is not deteriorating as you were expecting until now. And second, on dividend, can we say like a joke that you prefer to pay higher dividend because you are scared that Mr. Enria could put again a ban on dividends?
I'll answer both of your questions with a smile. So on my words and what they mean, you're starting to make me feel like a central banker, you know, interpreting my words, but I'm not that important, Christian, you know, so I'm just a guy trying to figure out what his P&L looks like in 2023. And, let's put it this way. We would really like to be reliable in terms of delivering the three-year plan, right? And we're still working on the positives and the negatives, and it's in any case going to be a very different P&L than we thought when we wrote the plan only 9 months ago. Right, it's going to be different in its build-up, different in its sources. So let me maintain this little bit of prudence before going further, and just say that we would really like to be reliable in the three-year plan, right? And that we will see if we can construct it in that way. But let me not make a promise now before I have the numbers, okay? Before I have the numbers solid. In terms of paying in the meantime, well, obviously there's a lot of debate at central bank level about the level of prudence that will be appropriate given the macro situation. There are some messages around buybacks and around extraordinary dividends, but there are no messages around normal dividends. So we are not rushing to pay because something may happen in 2023. I'm not expecting anything to happen to our regular 50% payout ratio in 2023. It's not in my hands, but we don't have any signal, and I'm not interpreting what's coming out of the central bank as something that will be something that will imminently, you know, impair our ability to keep the payout ratio where it is. And I also say this on the strength of the 16.18% CET1 ratio, which I think is, in the context of still retaining half your earnings and keeping them as capital, is, I think, a very, very comfortable number. And It's what I mentioned when I said consider that to be a an extra element that will make us reliable on the dividend policy. Okay?
Very, very clear. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you wish to register for a question, please press star and one on your telephone. The next question is from Andrea Lisi with Equita. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking the question. The first one is on the CET1. Wanted to understand which level of CET1 do you expect to land by year end? And the second one is on the management of cost. We have seen that revenues are above the business plan CAGR, but also costs are above because obviously inflation, also costs related to NPL management and so on. So if you plan to make actions to mitigate the increase in cost and in case of which are these actions. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Andrea. CT1 year end would be nice optically to keep it above 16, but I'm not sure. You have a little bit of volatility, right? I think I can promise that we'll be north of 15.5 in most scenarios, right? Remember that when we presented the business plan, we said we're going to gradually consume some capital, right, or absorb it, and we will in any case remain above 14, right, at the end of the plan. I think in the current environment, we will have, by the year end, we'll be above 15, surely 15.5 probably, but with a little bit of volatility. So, we might have a bit of loans, year end, it sometimes happens, right, that they ask us for some factoring volumes in the last month of the year. So we might have some risk-weighted asset growth, and I would really like to accommodate it without thinking about it too much, So given that it's quite comfortable, we're not going to manage for it, let's put it like that. It's going to end up where it ends up because, being a very nice, comfortable ratio, we're not going to manage for it or pay attention to it. So we might consume a little bit of basis points just to have business growth, right? Revenues and costs. Yeah, I accept the observation. Revenues are above, costs too. And we try to give you a bit of separation of the various types of costs and the dynamics that they're exposed to, right? So I take you to page 8, if I can, for a second, right? All in all, you could say it's sorry, I mean page 9, sorry. You have the part that's exposed to inflation, and I expect that to grow. I've already been told by my COO, Fabio Lanza is looking at me now, that we should expect more than a couple of millions next year, right, to come in on this blue part of the chart. That's energy costs, because we don't consume much, but still, we have the offices and everything, and we had an interesting conversation with the energy supplier last couple of months, leading us to really see what happens also to our clients, right? And in general, whenever something expires, when you sit down with the supplier and you talk about costs, right, you get to face an increase. By now it's become, pretty mainstream. So I would like to tell you, the light blue part, right, on the chart, we're keeping it down, and we have been keeping it down until now. We're doing everything we can, but I expect that thing to grow. HR, we're being quite judicious with hiring. You can see the FTEs not growing a lot. Actually, we'd like them to grow a bit. We want to make a bit of investment into the commercial part. We'd like to reinforce the network a bit. We think we can earn that investment back easily, right, given the commercial dynamic that we have. And I think, a few tens of people more in the network would be really nice in terms of client development and everything. So expect that number of FTEs to grow a bit, but not much. But We're going to have contract renegotiations by the with the unions on the sector level, right? So the whole of the banking industry is going to see the effect of those negotiations. I would expect those negotiations to lead to cost increase. So on the dark blue side, too, I think costs would be would tend to increase. Then we have the revenues related side, green. Those are good costs, if you will. Let's assume stable, all right, which means that we will be still vigorous, right? But we will earn the revenues on the NPL side. So what can we do beyond the contract renegotiation that we already mentioned? There's also a bit of selectivity, I think, in advisory costs that we can afford, and therefore, you know, work a bit on consumption. But overall, I think the equation is that costs will increase and that our challenge will be to increase revenues further, also, frankly, using the rate scenario. So, and this one of the reasons why I was a bit careful on 2023 and the numbers is that precisely these are the dynamics that we want to see in more detail before making explicit and definitive remarks about the guidance for next year. Okay? So what we can manage downwards, we will, but the things that I mentioned to you, some of them are frankly not so much in our control.
Clear. Thank you.
The next question is from Simonetta Chiriotti with Mediobanca. Please go ahead.
Hello, good afternoon. Couple of questions from my side. The first is on the public administration segment, the factoring segment. I would like to understand better your strategy going forward. If you are completely exiting this segment or just shrinking your presence in this business. And the second question is on the NPL business, where you said that you plan to reach your budget for the year in terms of purchases. Do you think that the market will change in the coming weeks, allowing you to do so? Because during the third quarter, basically the activity was very low. And finally, as far as the impact of the new decision of the government on pensions, if everything will be absorbed by the provision that you are going to make. Provision, I mean, the measure that you are going to take in the last quarter of the year, or if we can expect a lower profitability of this business also in the coming years. Thank you.
Yeah, so thank you, Simonetta. So public administration, are we planning on fully exiting this business? No. Are we looking at very serious selection of debtors today? Yes, forcibly. What is the consequence of that? The consequence of that is very limited purchases in the last months, right? As we digest the portfolio, whether or not clients will come back to sell us these invoices will also obviously depend on what the rest of the market does, right? What we want to explore is the extent to which it is possible to buy, like some other banks have been doing for years already, right? The extent to which it is possible to buy invoices, make sure that they are managed in a short time frame, make sure that we have documentation and proof of any commercial disputes in the cases where we have delays. Because if you have this documentation, invoice by invoice, then you are allowed not to classify it as past due. That's operationally a slightly different game. It's less remunerative because you will never have penalty rates, right? And it requires the people who sell you these invoices, i.e. the large pharma companies, the suppliers, right, it requires them to allow you to buy the invoices without buying exposure to those local health authorities that have particularly bad payment records. So it's not an exit, but it's a very severe reset of business practices leading to a very drastic drop in volumes that you've observed. How it will develop, it will also a bit depend on us, but also a bit depend on the market, okay? NPL business, you're saying we expect to make the budget of purchases. How is that possible when the market is so challenging? So I'm making this statement on the basis of a pipeline, right? We have quite a number of situations where we are quite far ahead. There's also some bilateral stuff in there on the secondary market. So we can't be sure, but if you ask me now, I think we have a reasonable shot at making the budget for the year. Will the market change? I'm not really assuming that over the next couple of months, right? I would assume that during 2023, we're going to have the investors factoring in a different environment into their purchasing behavior in terms of cost of funding and in terms of collection expectations, but not in the last quarter. So the reason why we mentioned this sort of intermediate level of confidence about making the budget is that we have, you know, some view on the pipeline and there are a couple of transactions which we think will come in over the next weeks. Finally, pensions. Is it absorbed, all of it, one-off, the impact? Yes. Yeah?
No, yes, the first impact. Okay, and we take the majority of the impact in 2022, probably, depending on our final, let's say, configuration. Of course, then there will be a recurrent impact, which is slightly quite low, let's say between 4-5 million, something like that. We are updating, checking the numbers, and refining our assumptions. This, for sure, will be part of our 2023 guidance. We will discuss in that moment.
Thank you, Martino.
Thank you.
Thank you, Simone.
Once again, if you wish to ask a question, please press star and one on your telephone. The next question is from Giuseppe Grimaldi with BNP Paribas. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, everybody. I have two questions. The first one is a clarification on the one-off item that you see. You were talking about 30, 40 million. So it's something that is going to be related primarily to the NPL in the fourth quarter, if I got it correctly. And the second point is on the funding. Considering what you have seen right now in the bond market, do you still plan to increase your exposure to bonds in terms of funding in the years to come, as you mentioned in your business plan, or everything is paused at the moment?
Yeah, so I agree, or I confirm, 30 to 40 million is mostly in the NPL business, yeah? It is all in the NPL business except for the little piece of TLTRO effect that we mentioned, right? That's recurring, by the way, it's not a one-off, right? So we're going to have a Q4 NPL business which is impacted quite significantly, right?
Okay.
In terms of funding, do we still expect to increase our exposure to bonds? Well, if you look at the current environment, it looks like quite a spectacularly inefficient way to finance yourself compared to other possibilities we have. If we look at retail funding now, we offer 3% today on 5 years deposit. And market appears to be accepting that nicely. I would expect the market to slightly increase that further, right, over the next months, and we will follow it like we always do, right? You have to be competitive in these products, or you won't collect money, right? But if you compare this with the, what is it now, 6-7%, right?
that we've seen on some senior issues, and I'm not talking about the price IFIS would get, I'm just talking about what I observe in the market, right? And we've seen these numbers on senior preferred bonds, right? Then, once again, you know, they look like quite spectacularly inefficient. Would we, all else being equal, prefer to issue paper on the market? Yes, because it allows for a more continuous relationship with the investors. Rating agencies like it. So there's lots of reasons why, if possible, we would continue to do it, even accepting a bit of inefficiency in terms of price. But currently, it looks like it would be really much more advantageous to use other forms we have, right? Both institutional and retail funding in other forms. No decision made yet. It's one of the things that will feed into the P&L next year. So there you go. It's yet another one of these Lego blocks, right, that we're playing with. To get the numbers in 2023. I think what we know now is what I've said. I don't think I can say anything further that would make any sense. Of course, if the market improves, we will be quite happy to issue. We saw a lot of issuance in the last couple of days, by the way, so it looks like maybe it's opening up again. Regardless of the conditions, there's also a question of availability, right? Last few days has been encouraging. January is usually a very intense month in terms of issuing. So I think if we take a bit of a look at how November goes, and we take a look at how January goes, we will be probably more informed to answer your question precisely.
Thank you. Thank you for the clarification.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Gerber, there are no more questions registered at this time.
So thank you all. Thanks to my team. Thanks to Martino. Thank you all for your attention. It's 5:15 on a Thursday afternoon. We've had lots of calls today. If you're still here, I really appreciate it. Thank you all.